The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today we're looking at gold. And, you know, there's a reason we're looking at gold. And this is the 11th successive rise in the gold market. I think it's worth discussing the overall viewpoint of why a person owns gold in the first place and what the supply and demand fundamentals are.
Well, Kevin, this is one of the great bull markets of the century, and it's still progressing steadily. And that's one of the things that we'll look at today is the progress that it's made. It feels to many like it is the tail end of a bull market. And what we would suggest is that while we've made great progress, there's still much that lies ahead. And that is borne out not only in the fundamental statistics, which we'll discuss today, but also, Kevin, in just the changes which still have to occur in both the fiscal and economic spheres, both here and abroad.
Well, and you know, David, if we were to look back 100 years, you know, go back to, say, 1911, 12, 13, right in that area, we'd see that during that period of time, 100 years ago, the world was very solidly under a gold standard. And in a way, we did have a solid one world currency. But, you know, things started breaking down from there. And I think if we start about 40 years ago, we start looking at the destruction of the system that really was backed by gold. And shouldn't we look at it from that point on?
Right. Well, essentially, Kevin, if you're saying that these are periods in time that we can understand in light of the policies that were in place, we have, as you said, the 11th annual rise in the gold price. And then that's on the heels of a 40th anniversary, Kevin. In August of this last year, we left the Bretton Woods era, that era where currencies were related to something real, and for the first time on a global basis, entered into a fiat-only world. This is an experiment which has now run its course after 40 years.
And talk about an experiment. I mean, Nixon said that was going to be a temporary move, the taking the dollar off the gold standard. They called it the closing of the gold window. Well, Dave, they've never opened that window back up again.
Well, and what we had then, Kevin, was a generational repricing of the metal. It had been stuck in the mud at $35 an ounce, set there arbitrarily back in the 1930s, and kept there through the Bretton Woods era. And it was 30 years ago, as of January 2010, that gold reached its nominal peak.
So yeah, for those who remember 1980, gold hit $850 an ounce, but that was because of that generational, or actually that decade-long repricing of gold.
Well, and it was moving to reflect an increase in inflation over a longer period of time. And that essentially is what we have today, Kevin, is a generational repricing. And it ultimately will reflect both the present inflation, which would take us actually to about $2,473 per ounce, but also the future inflation, I think, of the next 3 to 5 years most intensely.
Well, and let's put this in perspective. I mean, you're talking about if we were to take that $850 high back in 1980 and just put in what the government has called CPI, the inflation rate, that would be $2,473 today. But is that really factual? I mean, are those numbers, the government seems to always understate CPI.
That's a great point, Kevin, because the real world inflation adjusted prices are probably $1,000 to $1,500 higher. You know, it's interesting. Some academics see the long-term average price of gold reflecting really a neutral value change, as really any increase is just accounting for the annual inflation rate. Now, obviously, this takes place over a long period of time. It's not as if gold is an automatic adjustment for inflation.
So for the last decade, we're talking 10% a year. Is that accurate to what inflation probably is?
Well, we've had between 10 and 12% annual returns in the precious metals market, more if you're talking silver than gold, but say 10 to 12% for the gold market. So yes, you could say, and actually this is a perfect overlap to how Volcker used to count inflation. The calculations that he used then, when gold was hitting its peak, to look at what inflation was, if we used his metric, applied it to today's number, instead of the sub-3, which is currently assumed, we'd have north of 11% inflation.
So it's accurate. If gold was a neutral defender of value, let's say, or just preserver of value, it's really only rising what the inflation rate should be, valuing it the way Volcker counted inflation.
Right. Now, I'll be quite frank with you, Kevin. I don't think inflation is the only or even the primary mover of the metal, but it is one thing that it remains sensitive to. But there are a whole host of other things we can discuss at length today.
Well, I'll tell you, if we were to look back a decade, Dave, and go back to, say, the year 2000 or 2001, gold was less than $300 an ounce. I mean, what we ought to do, I think we just assume our listeners know what has happened over the last 10 years.
Well, Kevin, this is what is absolutely remarkable, because when you look at 300 and then you look at 1600, you say, well, that is a massive move.
Right.
But Kevin, on a year-by-year basis, I just want to go through sort of a laundry list of prices, and this is where each year the gold price began, okay, in this progression of a 10-year bull market. And what you'll note is that these moves are very modest. It's only in the accumulation of these years that you begin to see a dramatic thing happen, and it is one of the great bull markets of the century.
Dave, the growth was so subtle in 2001, 2002, 2003. I mean, people barely realized, without going back and looking at the calendar, if they had made any money or not.
And Kevin, between 2001 and 2, it was up $7. We'll just go in terms of, again, where gold opened at each one of these years.
Okay, Dave, let's start with 2001.
It started the year at $271.
Okay, now I'm going to yawn here. 2002.
$278.
Okay, almost still yawning, but a little more exciting. 2003.
$343.
Okay, so from 278 to 343. Now we're starting to see some motion, but 2004.
416, up from 343.
Okay, so we're still not super excited, but we're seeing that we're getting an increase that's matching the inflation rate anyway.
And then by 2005, it's 427.
Okay.
Over 416, you're not talking about a huge increase, but you're also not talking about a decrease.
Okay, but $500 was a huge psychological barrier. I remember that.
And we broke that in 2006. It began the year at 530, so we actually broke it in 2005, late in the year.
I see. Okay, and then 2007?
We began the year at $637.
Now, we go into the crisis year, Dave. Everybody remembers from 2007 to 2008, we had the Bear Stearns situation starting to brew. We started to see the Lehman thing coming down the road. People were starting to get nervous. 2008.
So fast-forwarding from 2008 to 2009, 2008, as we mentioned, was $846. 2009, $874. Not much of an increase, but still steady progress.
Well, and then the big psychological barrier. I talked about $500, but $500 was nothing compared to when gold broke 1,000, and that happened between 9 and 10, didn't it?
It did, and if you'll notice, these barriers, frankly, are multiples of the previous numbers. So 500 to 1,000, really the next psychological barrier, the critical one, is 2,000. We went from 500 to 1,000, 1,000 to 2,000. Again, these are where your considerable barriers lie. After 2,000, I would guess that the next major psychological barrier is 4.
Well, and we're working our way up there. I mean, 2011, we started at $1,388.50.
And then we began this year at $1,598.
Right.
So again, when you look at it from one year to the next, there's very little change, but it's in aggregate. And this is one of the things that I would like to emphasize. If you don't have patience in the context of a bull market, you never get to benefit from it. And this is a characteristic which is not common for investors to have. It's usually, what have you done for me in the last 3 nanoseconds? How have I traded myself to success and to retirement bliss in the last 5 minutes?
Right.
There really is no conception of time which is healthy. When you're dealing with money, the healthiest way to approach it is to include the largest swath of time as possible. Now, that's if you're thinking about intergenerational wealth planning. If you're talking about, as we are here, riding through a bull market, again, being patient is absolutely requisite to success, because, again, the journey from 271 to 1600 is very impressive, but it's been both laborious and boring at times, wherein you had periods of time where there was nothing happening, and yet it was still constructive.
David, something you pointed out about a week and a half ago, when gold did dip down to the 65-week moving average, which really is just an average of the price taken over the last 65 weeks of gold. Gold is a relatively stable, almost a yawner as far as its rise goes. But when gold goes down to that 65-week moving average, usually you've bottomed or close to bottomed out.
Well, Kevin, as you say, bottoming out at a particular point is not without coincidence. Well, the reason we use the 65-week moving average is because it smooths out the price action of the market and shows you basically where the baseline is for that market.
You could almost use it as a straight edge. Even though we see the actual day-to-day fluctuations looking like a sawtooth, if you flatten it out, you could almost use it as a flat edge, Dave.
Right. Take a ruler, and you're basically defining the general trajectory of the market. Only breached once in 2008. Kevin, one thing more on the 65-week moving average, because before we move past that, it's important to note, we drew attention to this as a significant place where we thought the market would bounce in terms of the decline in price would end and we'd see some recovery from there. Kevin, it's been less than 2 weeks. We're now $100 higher than that level.
Right.
And this week we've passed the 200-day moving average. average. It's a shorter term moving average. All I can say is that this is constructive. It's very productive, still constructive, and we look at this as a very fundamentally and technically sound market.
Well, David, even though the 65-week moving average, or just taking the prices at the end of the year, just the daily prices at the end of each year, seems to be a steady progression, there are changes in supply and demand all through that curve that probably aren't quite as equitable to that rise. I mean, the mining industry, I mean, talk about a volatile industry. It's so difficult to actually extract gold from the ground. Even when the price increases, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have an increased production, does it?
Kevin, I just read a report from Goldman Sachs, and it was interesting, the analysis that they had on this. It was basically, here's the miners that we think are going to do very well, particularly if they can just increase their output. And I thought to myself, they've failed to understand, as bright as these guys are, they've failed to understand we're not talking about creating widgets here. We're not talking about running an extra shift so that the factory can crank out ounces. We're talking about a very limited supply coming from mines. In fact, over the last decade, you've seen a slow erosion between 4 and 7%, depending on the year. That's a decline in mine supply. So we want to talk about supply and demand. Let's address the supply side first. It's not like you can just crank up production.
Well, you know what it reminds me of? There was an old commercial with Jay Leno for Doritos, and he said, Doritos, munch all you want. We'll make more. Well, it's not quite like that with gold.
No, you can't do that with Krugerrands. You can't do that with the Canadian Mint or what have you. But we continue to see a decrease in mine supply with recycled gold filling the gap.
Now, okay.
This has been an interesting component because there's been waves of people swapping out of their dated jewelry, as in out-of-fashion jewelry, and moving into cash, just raising a few bucks. And what's interesting is that is diminishing in scale as Western sellers have already taken advantage of what they consider to be already high prices. So,
right.
You know, we saw a huge wave at $1,000. We saw another wave between $1,200 and $1,300. We saw another wave, one of the biggest, around $1,500. And they were considering themselves the fortunate few to be picking high prices, to be taking this old junk gold and recycling it at, again, quote-unquote, historically the highest price ever.
Well, and this is not intended at all as an insult to the people who were taking jewelry in. Sometimes there were liquidity needs, other things, maybe having to pay for school. But it is more the unsophisticated investor or person who is taking that gold in at these prices. They're not necessarily looking at gold from a historical perspective. They just know they own something that's worth more now.
Well, and here's the fascinating thing, Kevin, because while current numbers of roughly 1,500 tons per year, 1,500 tons next to the 25 to 2,600 tons, which is from new mine supply. So you're talking about, in aggregate, 4,000 tons a year of available gold. We're talking about supplies which are not increasing organically. And in fact, we've seen these waves of liquidations of gold, and they're diminishing each time because it's not like you can empty your jewelry box twice. Once it's done, it's done. You captured that wave at 1,000. You captured that wave at 1,500. So we're actually seeing the demand side fade not only on the new mine supply, but also on the recycling side with these progressive waves.
Yeah, so David, when demand is increasing, investment demand, what have you, and you don't have enough supply to actually meet that demand, and what you're saying is a lot of the jewelry has already been sold into the market, and even if it does, the mines can't keep up with the demand as it increases.
Kevin, these are the two greatest inputs in terms of supply, 2,500 from new mine supply, 1,500 from recycling. Those are the most recent numbers in rough terms. Those are your two greatest supply inputs. Both of them are in decline while demand is increasing. I mean, if you're going back to Econ 101, this is not supposed to be the case. From a business standpoint, you can continue to increase supplies to meet demand, and you're fine. This is a case in point where there's not enough supply to meet demand, and that's where you begin to see the price not only continue to edge higher, but ultimately move in a parabolic rise.
Well, and David, I'd like to shift to the demand, because the demand is actually the larger factor. If you think about supply in the gold market, okay, so it's 4,000 tons. That still makes up less than, what, 3%? Of the total world gold supply that's already out there. So it's not like an incredible supply increase each year. It's just a very slow progress.
Kevin, I think one of the things that we suggested a few weeks ago on the commentary is that there's been a number of substructural changes in the marketplace. And one of those substructural changes is this assumption that we have in the West that the gold market is really oriented to the West. And what that is a faded memory from the 1970s and 80s. And let's talk about the numbers specifically, because North American and European buying was very considerable. 1970, it represented close to 50%. Exactly 47% of the global gold market in 1970 was North America and Europe.
Yeah, so you're basically counting what we would call the Western world at this point. And it was about half of the gold demand in 1970.
And it rose to a peak in 1980 with the gold price peaking at around $850. It peaked at 68%.
Right.
Now, it's been shrinking since then. Well, so Kevin, with the 70s and 80s in mind, you fast forward to 1990, and we'd already shrunk considerably. We were 68% at the peak. By 1990, it was just 38%. And if you fast forward to today, Kevin, we're about 27% of the gold market. That combines both European buying and North American buying as a percentage of the total global gold market.
Well, and David, you jumped from 1990 to present, but there was a fascinating phenomenon that occurred in Europe and America. Going to the top of the tech stock boom, you know, back in 2000, before the World Trade Center, okay, we had the stock market rising. You know, it was 14,000 sounded like nothing. Guys were coming out saying the stock market was going to be 35,000 in a matter of a couple of years. You had commercials that were just saying, we wasted $2 million, and yet they wouldn't even tell you what their product was. Money was flowing, paper money was flowing. We didn't need gold. In the year 2000, Dave, the Western world had, what, less than 5% of the demand. It was incredible.
Well, and specifically the U.S. market was infinitesimally small at that point. And Kevin, it's interesting, while the West was so enamored with paper investment products, it right. was Indian and East Asian investment demand that in the year 2000 accounted for 80% of the gold bought for that purpose.
Think about that. That was before the bull market. That was before they were getting the payoff. Now, they were buying that gold at low prices.
Kevin, exactly. That's a lot of buying at a very, very low cost basis. I mean, Kevin, when we look at why things are transitioning in terms of this investment component, we do have to continue to look at the geography and the change in terms of the distribution of these purchases, Kevin. Like we said, it was North American and European centric up until 1980. Since then, there's been a massive shift towards the east. The Indian subcontinent and East Asia went from, again, comparing to our 1970 numbers, they were at 35%. Now, they're at 58%.
So you're talking just East Asia and India. They're taking up almost 60% of the gold right now.
Right. We've seen a dramatic shift, Kevin, in terms of who's buying and in what quantities and for what purposes, which adds an interesting component, which we'll talk about in a little bit, Kevin, in terms of gold's correlation factor to sort of Western markets. In fact, it's very non-correlated, making it very attractive to an international audience.
You know, David, yesterday we were sitting and talking, and you said, is there anything we're missing in the gold market? Is there something that we, as close as we are to it on a daily basis, that we're missing? I'm going to admit that I've been missing. I understood the Asian component. I could spout off how much they were buying on an annual basis, but I hadn't really thought about it. We have this tendency here in America, I think our investors do, I know I do, to focus on how things move around or circle the United States or the European markets. But in reality, what's going on in the gold market is almost disconnected from the Western markets, because the Asians are the ones who are running this thing.
So, Kevin, yeah, again, out of that 4,000 tons that's used up every year, how is it used up? 2,000 tons of it goes into jewelry. Basically, half the market goes into jewelry. What's interesting, Kevin, is that investment demand is now at about 38%, and the difference is going into industrial purposes, technology, and whatnot. So 38, 50, and then a small difference in between for industrial purposes. That 38%, Kevin, does not include central bank purchases.
Well, okay, you're talking about central bank purchases right now, but for the career that I have had here over the last 25 years, for the most part, central banks were selling gold. They just became net purchasers over the last few years.
Up until 2009, when it virtually stopped. If you look at the central bank gold agreement liquidations, they occurred regularly for decades.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, like clockwork. You could expect each of the European central banks to dump product. And Kevin, frankly, we were the beneficiaries of that. For years and years and years, we had access to mint state coins, stuff that had never been circulated, sat in bank vaults, original bags of Dutch guilders and British sovereigns and things that had been held as a currency reserve,
right,
and now were coming to us for the first time. And this is when a British sovereign was $102 a coin, now 4 to 5 times that in terms of a retail purchase price. Kevin, the world has changed in large part because those supplies are no longer available.
Central banks don't want to sell that stuff.
Actually, there was only one liquidation in 2010 by Germany. Since then, the balance has tilted in favor of central bank purchases. Kevin, we saw a significant trend change here in the last few years, but we continue to expect net purchases to increase because you've got total reserve ratios relative to gold, which are still very, very low. Kevin, you've got a lot of these surplus countries that have resources that they need to invest. And do they want euros? Not particularly. Do they want dollars? To some degree, they have to.
Right.
But the question is, how do you offset your currency exposure in fiat paper that you don't particularly like? And you basically create the anecdote within your own portfolio by owning gold.
So what you're saying, okay, the central bank purchases have begun to make an impact. But in reality, even without them, investment demand, it's 38% at this point. We're seeing it rise very quickly.
Well, Kevin, the argument is often used, I mean, going back to the largest component of gold demand, which is still jewelry, it's argued that you see demand destruction, if you're following me, as the price of gold increases. In other words, as gold goes from $1,000 to $2,000 an ounce, people just aren't interested. They're not willing to pay the price.
It's too expensive, they say.
Right. But that's actually not the case, Kevin. I mean, if you look at, say, Indian demand in this last year, it was constant in rupee terms. So actually, you had a couple of percent increase in terms of the money spent on gold. But because of the increase in price, it bought less ounces. And that's how most people consider this sort of demand destruction equation.
So smaller bangles, but you're still buying bangles for the same amount of money.
Right, exactly. So, Kevin, let's say you are in India, and last year you spent ₹1 trillion on gold. Well, the next year you spend ₹1 trillion on gold, but this time around it doesn't buy you as many ounces.
It's a little less gold.
Are you spending less on gold, or are you just getting less gold for the same money?
Right.
And that is what's actually happening, Kevin. That's what's happening. We're seeing folks who had started IRAs 4, 5, 6 years ago and would put in $5,000 and it would buy 800 ounces of silver. Today it buys less than 200 ounces. It doesn't mean they're any less committed to buying silver or gold today. It just means that because of the increase in price, they can't afford as much as they used to be able to buy.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. You know, David, I was thinking about that when we talked about this earlier. We, as a company, used to have a $220 gold piece minimum. $220 gold pieces at $400 or $500 was just about a $1,000 minimum. Right now, those same two cost what 10 did back then. I mean, now we're still seeing somebody come in with, you know, $1,000, but they'll have to buy a half an ounce of gold or less. And this is probably what we're seeing overseas in India, what have you. People are still buying gold. They have to buy less of it. Now, what that also does is that points out again what you were talking about with mine supply and all this. They may not be able to increase supply, but people still buy at the higher price.
I want to go back to the 1980s, Kevin, because that was a period in time where the U.S. and European buyer was active.
Mm-hmm.
And 50% of the demand was going into investment-related things. It was the U.S. and Europe. Today, it's 38%, with us basically not even factoring in, while it's Asia and the sub-Indian continent, which is dominant in that 38% investment demand component. Here's what I want to get to. The West has not shifted gears meaningfully and engaged this bull market. It's fascinating, Kevin. We suggested this about 3 or 4 months ago. I was just coming back from Europe, and supplies were non-existent. You can't find gold available, even in the retail space, because demand is off the charts. We were seeing tens of tons, and then ultimately hundreds of tons in the fourth quarter, consumed for investment purposes in Europe. Finally, after 10 years, it captured the European imagination that they needed to own gold as an offset to losses and volatility that they had in their other assets. What brought it home was a crisis in the banking arena in Europe. We don't have anything local U.S. that has focused U.S. buying attention, and I think that's very interesting, because if I had a prediction for 2012 to 2014, it is that Western demand, both European and U.S., which I mentioned, European has already launched higher with the focus on European bank issues,
right?
That'll add an extra 10 percentage points onto total investment demand in an environment where supply is not keeping up. You can't afford to see. This is Jeff Christian from the CPM Group saying, listen, you're going to make the market go higher even with 2% increase in investment demand. I would suggest that over the next 24 months, we see between Europe and the U.S. an increase of 10 percentage points to that investment demand component, driving up competition for limited ounces. This is where you get into a very aggressive growth environment.
Well, and David, you know, we talked about the analogy. The people from Europe were jumping into gold, but they're also jumping into dollars. The dollar has really benefited this last quarter from the crisis, the Merkel-Sarkozy trying to solve European crisis that continues to get worse. But we liken that to jumping from the Hindenburg onto the deck of the Titanic. But there is a point where they have to jump into this little bitty lifeboat, and there aren't enough lifeboats. This is the gold. Okay, the Hindenburg is the euro, the Titanic is the dollar, and hopefully people are getting the analogy here, but the lifeboat is gold, and you don't have any way of increasing the amount of lifeboats when you need it.
Well, Kevin, this is, again, just a reminder of how U.S.-centric we are, or even Western-centric we are in our analysis. We look at the growth in the exchange-traded funds, and when you look at the numbers, it's actually more of a Western institutional product. We've seen a huge bias. Okay, there's people buying gold and it's in ETFs. Kevin, the primary interest in bars and coins globally, it's gone into private holdings. It's not gone into ETFs. And this is the major component in investment demand. The ETFs are almost a side note, even though that has been a critical variable in adding liquidity to the U.S. and European market. The rest of the world could care less about selling gold.
They're
the
buying bars and coins.
And we'll get into the reasons why they own it, but it's not just a trade. It's not just a convenient exposure. It's not just an asset allocation. For most of the world, particularly the Asian and Indian subcontinent, Kevin, you're dealing with something that comes into the family portfolio and never leaves. That is a very interesting component.
Well, okay, let's look at the various. Since we're saying let's try to not look myopically here as United States citizens, okay, let's look at how the world views gold. Let's take the East, for example. Their wealth preservers. We already know how the Asians save. I mean, they'll save 25 or 30% of their paycheck, even if they're hungry.
But see, this is the problem. If they're putting it in a bank, let's say, for instance, that you're in Vietnam, and you're facing not 5% inflation, but last year's numbers of between 22 and 25% inflation.
Right. What do you do?
Kevin, so at least on the point of inflation, we do see an Eastern emphasis as inflation and wealth preservation are connected ideas. But to some degree, Kevin, actually, if you're looking at wealth preservation, that's really a Western bias. You own it as an offset to losses or whatnot. There's other things, Kevin, that I think you see emerging in Asia, and that is profit motive. We've had such strong returns.
They've had 30 years of growth, David. They're starting to get that taste that we had during the real estate move.
Well, exactly. Not only do they see growth in their economy and new sources of income, Kevin, which with to feed their savings and thus their gold purchases, but they're also looking at the growth in the gold market over the last several years, set against their local inflation rates, and they realize, hey, this is something that we can actually make money on. So strong returns are also an appeal.
So it's not just wealth preservation. They're actually speculating on price.
Right. You also move to that part of the world, Kevin, and you find that gold is a status symbol. And you see this to some degree here in the United States.
But India. Especially.
But, oh, absolutely. I mean, how many bangles are you wearing?
Right.
I mean, there is a statement of this is how well I'm taken care of. This is who we are as a family. This is a part of our identity. Kevin, so status does play into it, and that's not something you sell at high prices. That's something you want to communicate even more of. Look what I have at these high prices. What does this tell you about the rest of my wealth? So there is a, very much a social statement in the ownership of gold for the largest part of the world, which is today buying it.
Well, and you know, speaking of Asia, it's not just self status. I mean, as far as, like, look at the earthquake in Japan, how much gold was given as gifts to show just how deep the relationship was with the person who was affected.
Well, Kevin, that's exactly right. Last year was a fascinating period in time because the consumption specifically for jewelry and things like this in Japan was off the charts. It was actually in the aftermath of the quake. And again, it was that reappraisal of relationship. How much you mean to me. I want to show you how much you mean to me. There's this huge increase in gold gifting, if you will. And actually, 2012 sets up to be a pretty nice year for that, too. If you're looking at the Pacific Rim in general, China in specific, this is the year of the dragon. Year of the dragon and gold gifts for newborns, that's a very popular idea. So, again, you and I think about, what are you doing? You're giving a gram of gold. You're giving an ounce of gold. You're giving a piece of jewelry that, in terms of its total weight, means nothing. Kevin, in aggregate, we're talking about 2,000 tons a year for these kinds of little itty-bitty gifts. That's staggering. It's in aggregate that you realize this is where your billions and billions and billions of people buying a little bit of gold makes a big difference.
And that's not really a Western phenomenon. This is, again, in an effort to try to think a little bit different, to say, what are we missing? We don't have that Eastern mindset, that mentality. Well, then, David, we've talked about Volcker's numbers being about 10% on inflation. You know, we've talked about the government calling it 3%. Both of those, they sound pretty affecting to us, but developing world, inflation can be much higher than that. You have to hedge, like you talked about before.
Well, and Kevin, that's where you see in developing nations a major emphasis on gold as an inflation hedge. You know, whether that is in India, whether that is in Vietnam, whether you can pick your country, but where we have benign inflation, even if it's low double digits, you end up with much more aggressive inflation elsewhere. Whatever we've created in terms of exporting fiat currency, it ends up showing up on the shores of our foreign trade partners and creating real havoc in their money system. So, Kevin, I think as an inflation hedge, you continue to see that as a primarily developing nation emphasis, but something that is coming front and center to a theater near you in the West.
Well, and you know, when we talk about portfolios growing over in these developing countries and in Asia, they have to diversify because the stock market isn't necessarily the choice of everyone.
Well, Kevin, except in China, because you may have read this morning that the Chinese government is enforcing pension purchases of capital assets. In other words, they want people to buy stocks and bonds now. I mean, this is a last-ditch effort, frankly, to save the stock market in China by forcing the hand, putting a gun to the average investor and saying, you'll take an interest in this whether you like it or not. The instinct of the average investor is to buy value and to avoid that which has sort of an air pocket underneath it,
right,
where they think there's going to be an immediate decline, you step aside. Kevin, portfolio diversification and this notion of correlation among stocks, this is something that's very important, not only to those in the East, those in the West. This is a global issue.
Explain correlation to the listener who doesn't understand what you're talking about, worldwide correlation of the stock market.
Right. Well, it's just this. We know what correlation is. Two things being very related.
Right.
So you would assume that if you're buying different kinds of companies, that they're going to behave differently in the marketplace. You know, buying a biotech stock, it's probably going to perform differently than a consumer staples or something like a miner. But guess what? In 2011, and we're talking about the global equity markets, not just the U.S. market, 86% correlation, with 80% being about the norm, the average for the year.
So if stocks are up, stocks are up. If stocks are down, stocks are down.
And it doesn't matter what stock you picked. It doesn't matter if you have a particular insight. It doesn't matter if you're applying Graham and Dodd and doing great research analysis into what represents the greatest value. You may have bought the best company, and it's moving exactly in line with the general equities market. Up or down, doesn't matter the homework you put into it.
Okay, so to correlate a portfolio, I mean, how much is gold correlated to the stock market?
Well, Kevin, that's an interesting shift because, again, going back to the demand side of this, what we've seen is a shift away from North America. We've seen a shift away from Europe in terms of the consumption of gold, Kevin, which really represents a shift away from correlation for gold because the consumption component is not really oriented to Europe or North America. The financial centers there, the buyers of gold there, when they have to liquidate for whatever purposes, even a John Paulson who liquidates a third of his gold position because he's got to meet redemptions. He lost a ton of money last year, right, and had to meet client redemptions. Okay, so he's liquidating. Guess what? It really doesn't affect the supply and demand variables because most of your buying is not being done by U.S., New York, and London hedge funds. This is being done in Asia, and so it is creating even more of a non-correlation between gold and financial assets. At most, we saw it about a 15% correlation this last year, whereas in most of your securities, we're trading 86% correlation.
So if a person is trying to diversify outside of the equities risk-reward market,
that's a portfolio diversifier.
They have to do gold.
You bet.
That brings us to risk reduction in general. Okay, diversification in a portfolio reduces your risk, but we've talked about reducing risk of inflation. We've talked about reducing risk, actually, of a complete currency collapse or some sort of regime change. You know, we see China back in the 40s. When the regime changed there, their currency, people rushed to try to transfer into gold before that changed.
No, risk reduction is definitely a variable, Kevin. And I think this becomes front and center as we head into 2012, 2013. We have got so many onion layers of complexity in the derivatives world, Kevin, where it is impossible to calculate what happens when one firm fails. And that's why our Fed, that's why the ECB has been so defensive in terms of allowing firm failures, let alone country defaults. And that's what we're really talking about here, Kevin, in terms of risk reduction. More and more people are looking at gold and saying, hey, wait a minute, this is great collateral if I do need to get a loan. But furthermore, if someone's willing to pledge it, it's collateral that has no fuzz on it. We like this as an asset class on the balance sheet. We like this as something where we have some clarity as to what the value is.
Yeah.
Open the newspaper. and you've got your ounces times the current price, there's your value. So, Kevin, there is a risk reduction as people are trying to put it into a portfolio to say, I don't like my counterparty risk. I know what this is. I know where it is. I've got control of it. That's an interesting component in terms of risk reduction.
Well, and in an effort to think differently, think outside of the American box, one of the things that's really boxed our thinking is we see cash as neutral because it had been the reserve currency, or it still is the reserve currency of the world, and it had been backed by gold. So we still have momentum from that period of time where we were a gold-backed reserve currency. But, you know, let's say the person who's seen their currency change 3-4 times in their lifetime, their savings, that's what they think of as gold. They don't think of currency as neutral. They think of gold as savings. Yeah, I'm thinking like the Taiwanese.
Kevin, what you're really talking about in terms of us being a reserve currency and there being this privilege of saying, you know, we can move to cash and it's a neutral position,
right.
It assumes a certain position that doesn't exist any longer. It's a little bit like when you graduate from high school, you're at the top of your game. You're either the high school prom or the quarterback of the football team. And what happens between your senior year of high school and your freshman year is a total recalibration. You get no privilege. There is no free pass. It doesn't matter how good you were because there's a lot of other valedictorians who are starting out as freshmen. And we don't realize that. As investors, we look at cash and we say, particularly if it's dollar denominated,
right,
I'm moving to a neutral position. Balderdash, you're choosing to take risk. Now, at times we do choose to take that risk and at times we don't, but to assume that it's neutral is to assume that we still have the legitimacy, which was implied in that Bretton Woods era where there was some sort of correlation to gold.
Yeah, David, it's amazing. Yeah, I'll talk to clients and I'll say, now, where are your other investments? And they'll say, oh, well, I don't invest. I just keep my money in the bank. So that is just validating what you're saying. I think the same way oftentimes. Even though I have gold and even though I don't trust cash, what's the first thing that I do when I get paid? I put it in the bank first, and then I figure out where else to go.
And you assume that that's a neutral position, but it's not. You're speculating in a volatile currency, a currency which is backed by nothing and represents a balance sheet which is totally bankrupt. So that's what you're speculating on when you're at a bank. Not that the bank itself is insolvent. This is the same appraisal, Kevin, that's happening on a worldwide basis and why gold is becoming... This is one more reason why we've talked about a couple of things here, Kevin. Wealth preservation, strong returns, the status that it entails, gifting, an inflation hedge, portfolio diversification.
But nothing beats gold.
As a monetary asset.
As a monetary asset.
As a monetary asset. And it became that in the 1970s, in 1980s, and then fell out of favor as structured products and securities gathered the imagination in one mass within the marketplace to invest on one theme. Kevin, we are different here in the West. If you look at the East, Kevin, the Taiwanese have had a gold passbook program since 1997. You could take your savings and put it directly in gold and basically write checks from your gold account in Taiwan. Kevin, this is the same thing that we talked about in several of our public speeches 2 years ago as the CIBC, the Commercial Industrial Bank of China, and the World Gold Council were putting together at that stage and now have successfully completed savings accounts in China. Note to self, CIBC, how many branches do they have throughout China so that they can help distribute this gold savings program? Oh, only 18,000. Small branch banking. But we're talking about, Kevin, a program that you can add to 1 gram at a time, and they're now into several tons of gold stored for that particular program. Most bankers in the West, Kevin, they don't know what to do with gold. They don't know what to do with it because it doesn't have a cash flow. Because it doesn't have a cash flow, they're not even willing to consider it as collateral. But this goes back to, Kevin, what I mentioned just a minute ago. You go to Europe and you go to Asia, and gold has been used as reliable collateral, a real pledge, for many, many decades, if not centuries. It's only here in the U.S. where bankers don't know what to do with this stuff.
Okay, David, lest we sound like just gold bugs, that gold's just the thing to have all the time for every occasion, let's restate for a moment. We have talked for 40 years about what we call the perspective triangle. Okay, the base of the triangle is keeping at least a third of your portfolio in gold, whether it's up or down. The left side of the triangle is the growth mandate. That's the equities, stocks, bonds, or whatever you're trying to actually make grow. And then, of course, the right side of the triangle is the cash. Now, with gold going up, of course, that base of that triangle continues to grow larger and larger. And you've addressed there are timing strategies as to when we take the cream off the top or we reduce the amount that we have of gold in the portfolio. Now, would you readdress the Dow gold ratio?
I will, but I want to come back to the triangle first because, Kevin, you're right in saying the foundation doesn't change. The market changes and the valuations may change. If you started with a third, you may now have two-thirds.
Right.
But here's the question I have to ask you. If you hop on a sailboat Is there at any point, whether you're done with the sail before or after, that you say, okay, let's get rid of the keel?
Sailboats don't work without the keel. You and I both know that because we had a sailboat, David.
And we lost the keel at the bottom of a lake. And it's not easy to sail without a keel.
You need the gold as a keel for your portfolio.
But it's not the water, and it's not the wind in the sails. It's not the things that you consider more elemental in the sailing process. It's one of those things that's taken for granted.
Right.
We would suggest that the base of the triangle is what you take for granted. It's what stays. It's what stabilizes. It's what allows a clear course, and it's what should be a part of your wealth structure from here to four. Now, the question is, and you raised this earlier, if you have a third and it's now 50% of your portfolio because of the growth in gold, as we've seen that growth occur from 2000 to the present,
right.
Radical growth, 4 or 5 times the increase in value, guess what you need to do? You need to have a reduction strategy. Again, it's that taking the cream off the top, Kevin, and as more cream is created, if you see continued growth in that investment, then you continue to take cream off the top.
And you move it to the other two sides of the triangle.
You reallocate. Kevin, there is no silver bullet in investing. Anyone who says you should be 100% in gold, frankly, is overconfident and thinks that they know more than they actually do. Anyone who thinks they should have 100% in cash, this would be defining the deflation camp, frankly, defines a group that thinks they know more than they do.
Right.
Anyone who assumes that you should be 100% in equities, which largely defines the Wall Street crowd.
It does.
Again, it defines a group of people that think they know more than they actually do. We like the balanced approach because it starts with one of the things that we predicate success on in the investment world, and that's humility.
Yeah.
What do we know and what don't we know? And we need to continue to ask that question. What do we know and what don't we know? There's changing variables in the marketplace, and we want to maintain that balance. So, Kevin, as risk reduction, what we were talking about earlier as a portfolio diversifier, Kevin, certainly the strong returns, but for us, it has nothing to do with that. Frankly, our orientation is not towards the returns, which are just gravy. It is towards the wealth preservation.
Sure.
It is the role that that foundation plays. Again, if you wanted that other analogy of a keel for a ship, it's a stabilizer.
Right.
It does nothing else. You're still going to have to zig and zag to catch the wind. But it's a stabilizer on whatever course you choose, and that's why it stays with you as a mandate, as an insurance mandate. The mandate doesn't go away.
Okay, but David, what about the Dow gold ratio? Because you've used that as an example of when we're going to start telling people to reduce the size of that keel back down to a third of their portfolio.
Kevin, this is the challenge, because, and I think this is why the math helps make some sense of the challenge ahead. As we move into a phase where gold is $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce, Kevin, we're going to see the world around us look very ugly, very grim, and very hopeless. And that is classically when you have the best values in terms of productive assets. So when it seems darkest, that's when people want to hold on to their insurance, want to hold on to their gold, and do nothing but buy more, even at higher prices. When, in fact, they should be in that reduction stage, in that reallocation stage, buying assets that are now trading at extreme discounts. This comes down to a point of view. Is the world coming to an end? If it's coming to an end, frankly, it doesn't matter how many ounces of gold you own. That's not going to help you.
Right.
Kevin, I'm not sure if in that final analysis, if the world's coming to an end, if it even matters how many rounds of ammunition you own,
right.
Let alone ounces of gold, it doesn't matter. It just simply doesn't matter. Our assumption is that there is some repetition within history wherein you see human sentiment swing from extremes of greed to fear, and it's those periods where fear is most intense, where the mass mind is operating in absolute panic, that you have to keep your mind and make a wise decision to reallocate. We like the math because it forces an early exit. Early, yes. Are you going to capture every dollar in this gold bull market? No. If you wait around for it, guess what happens? Pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. That's the classic Wall Street phase describing someone who has overstayed their welcome, someone who's tried to maximize every dollar in a move. We suggest 3-to-1, 2-to-1, 1-to-1 is this gradual approach to when the Dow Jones Industrial Average divided by the spot price of gold gets to these ratios, you begin letting the market own some of your gold and you begin to move into and dollar cost average into a portfolio of productive assets.
Okay, so let me slow down a little bit. 3-to-1, 2-to-1, and 1-to-1. All right, let's say that a person has well beyond a third in gold in their portfolio, okay? And let's say the Dow is 12,000 points, to use a round number. If gold today was at $4,000, a 3-to-1 ratio, you at that point would start looking at advising people to start reducing their gold holdings, not below a third of their portfolio, but reducing what you called the cream.
Well, Kevin, that's exactly the point. You cannot, even in that period of darkest demise, if you think it's the country, if you think it's the currency, if you think it's the world as we know it, you have to read history to know that people have felt this way before.
All right. So it's no longer 4,000, David. You've called me and you've said, hey, Kev, gold's 4,000, the Dow's 12,000. Remember what we talked about? We prepared for this ahead of time. Are you willing to send a little of that money to the other two sides of the triangle? Let's say I did. All right. Now gold goes to 6,000 and I call you up and I say, Dave, I just missed $2,000 worth of the move. And you'll say, well, guess what, Kev? Funny you called. It's 2-1 at this point. Remember the conversation we had.
And what's your cream that you're taking off the top is now buying that much more in productive assets, actually a multiple of productive assets.
Even though I feel like I may have lost some of the gain, I'll say, all right, Dave, I trust you on this. You manage money. You've managed money for a long time. You've managed paper assets as well as gold. So I'm going to move another third or something of that equivalent of what I have in gold over into the other two sides of the triangle. Now I'm going to take you to the last one, Dave, because the reason we talk about 1-1 is because it's happened before. It happened in 1896, okay? It happened very closely in 1932. It happened in 1980. So we have seen 1-1 ratios before on the Dow, and they have always been very close to the bottom of the Dow. So gold goes to 12,000. I know this sounds crazy. The Dow is still 12,000 call.
It helps our math in terms of just showing you 1-1 ratio.
Exactly. And I say, Dave, you know, you were right about the ratios, but by golly, I'm so sorry I missed that gain in gold. And you say, well, you're going to have to trust me one more time. I want you to move another third of what's left over. Now, here's the crazy thing. I still have more dollars in gold than I ever did, even taking a third out the first time, a third of what's left over the second time, a third of what's left over the third time. If you do the math, I still have a very nice gold portfolio that I can pass down to my kids, but I've created a gigantic structure on the other two sides of the triangle.
Kevin, I'm most fond of General Electric just as an analogy because it's the only Dow component left after the last 100 years.
Right.
And so just not because it's my favorite company by any stretch, but because it's been around for a while anyways. In the last 10 years, Kevin, as this ratio, Dow gold ratio, has reduced from 43-1 down to the current 8-9-1, what we've seen is the opportunity cost. If you had bought GE in 2000, you'd be upside down 60-70% on your purchase. And the growth in gold in that same time frame is put 4-5-fold on the table. So what we're really talking about is as this ratio reduces, it increases your purchasing power in a stock like General Electric in a huge way. Modest investment in GE or in gold 10 years ago, $30,000 would have bought you 500 shares. That same money translated in gold terms today buys you over 8,000 shares.
What an amazing increase.
From 500 to 8,000 shares. Now, I think when all is said and done, as this ratio reduces from the current 8 or 9 to 1 down to 4, 3, 2, and 1 to 1, you're talking about what would have been an original purchase of 500 shares of GE, which is prospective for the gold owner today, going to be 30, 40, 50,000 shares of the same company. And we're talking about with a very modest sum. Kevin, we have an entire client base that has seen radical appreciation with very modest sums of money, and it puts them in a position to be able to capture these kinds of values, which frankly are once in a lifetime.
And we're not talking about dropping the keel off the boat to do it either. You keep the keel, but you actually add to the rest of the boat.
That's right. I think that's why part of the reason we rehearse this in our own minds and with clients in conversation is because by the time we get there, the environment will be so intense. Again, imagine gold at $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 an ounce, and you know that we're in utter chaos financially and maybe even monetarily here in the United States. Guess what? It's tough to make a decision in that environment, just as it would have been in 1932, in 1949, or in 1982, where there really were no growth prospects. The general market had thrown in the towel and said, we're not interested in equities, to heck with it. There's nothing but losses ahead in that area. And in fact, those were the turning points where all you had was gains from that point forward. Kevin, I suppose this is with some consistency that on an intergenerational basis, our family and our companies take a contrarian view. Just when everyone is clamoring for gold, why would we be insane enough to suggest that people sell it? Because history's on our side. history's on our side and is proven time and time again. When the mass mind says, we want no more, that's when you want to say, yes, we want a little bit of it. It's just to act as a contrarian, not for the sake of being
an iconoclast.
Right. But we're not trying to prove something. This isn't the artist just proving that he's different. Okay, that's not it. This is looking at history and saying, there's some design within human nature which freaks out and is either freakishly greedy or freakishly fearful. And you don't want to operate at those extremes. When the mass mind is buying tech stocks, 1998, 1999, 2000, there's something wrong. The sniff test should be failing. Why? Because everyone's doing it. Everyone's doing it.
Yes, so David, what we're doing is we're looking forward and we are mentally rehearsing for a future event. But for right now, you would keep your gold and keep your powder dry.
Keep my gold. I added some to it yesterday on a personal note. Kevin, I say that from my personal portfolio perspective because I think that the opportunity that opened up, the decline from 1920 down to about 1538, we're now $100 higher than that. We're in the rebound phase. Kevin, I think this is a great time to be looking at the market. Buy the dips if you can. The market is not finished.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.